On this episode of The Corp, we talked to Barry Sternlicht, who is the CEO of Starwood Capital. He also founded, created the W Hotel brand. If you've ever stayed at a W Hotel, you have Barry to thank. He manages billions of dollars, and we have a really interesting conversation coming up with Barry. Before we do that, though, a quick shout out to our presenting sponsor, the Cash App. They have basically created the Corp. They are the biggest backer of the Corp podcast, and we want to thank them. And you need to thank us for thanking them by downloading the Cash App right now. They're the number one app in finance, and they've rolled out their powerful new debit card, the Cash Card. The Cash Card comes with boost discounts that allow you to swipe and save 10% or more at Whole Foods, Shake Shack, Chipotle, Taco Bell, Chick-fil-A, coffee shops around the country, and tons more. It's basically free money. We're giving you free money if you want to be financially frugal. No, frugal is a bad word. Financially stringent. No, that's also a
financially
bad word.
Wise.
Wise. Financially wise, download the Cash App, save 10% on all these places that you go to anyway. They continue to hook it up. So people, you need to go download the Cash Card, the Cash App, download it. The Cash App. Thank you to them. They are our great presenting sponsor. Okay, so Barry Sternlicht, like I said, manages billions of dollars. And the theme that I took away from our conversation with Barry is how great he is at managing people more than money and being a team player in business and working with different type of people and adapting and making sure that everyone can kind of come along with him. So you've worked in, you've been with teams both in sports and business. What's the biggest piece of, getting a team, rallying a team together and getting everyone kind of pulling on the same side of the rope? How do you get people to do that?
First of all, is people selection, right? Is you have to bring in people that have high acumen, people that understand, that have high energy, that understand teamwork. I love hiring former great athletes. So I don't know why I hired you. But anyways, that's a side note.
Yeah, I did play the little pickup hoops,
6 a.m.
Yep.
So I think the selection of people is the most important thing, and then bringing them in together and having aligned interest. There's a great saying that there's no alignment unless there's financial alignment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Barry has done a fantastic job. Like most great, titans in business, he has a fantastic team. Barry's an interesting guy because he went to Brown undergrad, went to Harvard Business School, founded Starwood Capital.
Ever heard of him?
Manages over, literally, over $100 billion of assets around the world.
So I always wonder, and this is probably a bad thing to say on a business podcast, but like, what if a few bill just fell off the back of the truck?
He should have given you some money.
I guess that would be stealing, yeah. But I always wonder, like, if you have that much money, why not give me like 10 grand? That's not that much. It's nothing. It's a drop in the bucket. But Barry is a fantastic businessman. Really interesting to talk to him. Who was your favorite teammate that you ever played with?
Wow, that's such a great question. I'll tell you what. I'll give you one for the three teams that I played. So
okay.
One in each team.
Yep.
I would say in Seattle, there were so many great guys, but I would go with Edgar Martinez.
Okay.
He's I always say he has a PhD in hitting from mm-hmm. Harvard. He was my mentor and teacher. In Texas, I would say he was Michael Young.
Ooh.
Michael Young, who's now an executive for the Rangers.
Third baseman.
He played a little bit of second, a little bit of short, a little bit of third. Around the horn.
Uh-huh.
Class act. And then in New York, I would say
Nick Swisher.
I love Swish, but not
nope.
Swish.
Nope.
I love Swish. He's still my teammate at TV. I would say probably a combination. I'm going to go old and young. I'm going to say older. I'm going to say Mariano Rivera.
Yep.
A true, talk about the epitome of a world champion mm-hmm. and just a sniper. I mean, he is one lethal man, and I love him. Tough love, but was always the first one there when things went bad. I'll never forget that.
Yep.
And then I would say Robinson Cano because he's like my little brother. And just a good man.
Robbie Cano, don't you know? Isn't that what they said?
He's a bad man.
Yeah, absolutely. Might be a Yankee again.
Maybe.
There's some rumblings. Who knows?
Maybe.
Okay, so let's get to our talk with Barry Sternlicht.
And one last thing before we get started. Barry at 31 was bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
He was insecure. He didn't know where to go. He didn't know where the next dollar was going to be. He actually told us that he learned his biggest lesson from his former boss on how not to do something. He took that information and then went out and started Starwood Capital. And today, from 31 bankrupt to managing over $100 billion of real estate assets around the world. For you young folks listening, at 31 bankrupt, if Barry can do it, so can you.
Yeah, and it's a great point because I think a lot of people see a fabulously wealthy person, a successful businessman, they think, well, they probably have been just dominating their entire career, and that wasn't the case. Barry had a lot of times where he didn't know where his next paycheck was going to come from, and kind of pulling himself up off the mat is what made him who he is today. So let's get into it. Barry Sternlicht, CEO of Starwood Capital. Reminder, if you enjoy these podcasts, please rate, review, subscribe, unsubscribe, tweet us, tell us, interact with us. We'd love to hear from the people. Here he is, Barry Sternlicht.
You're listening to The Corp, presented by Barstool Sports.
Okay, we welcome on CEO of Starwood Capital Group. It is Barry Sternlicht. You know him from the W Hotels. You know him from Starwood Hotels. Entrepreneur, been very successful in business. So we don't have a ton of time, but I wanted to do a quick just backstory so people can kind of get to know you a little bit. Where in your life did you start the entrepreneurial spirit? Where did you, like, you know, a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I sold lemonade as a kid.
Yeah,
at what moment were you like, okay, this kind of life is for me?
I sold knives door to door.
Did you? Cutco?
Yeah, Cutco knives.
Yeah, there you go.
Second ranked in the county.
Yeah, nice.
And I taught tennis. And okay. I sold knives. I like set up a picnic table at the courts, and I sold the knives to the gals I was teaching tennis to.
Yeah. So you grew up in Connecticut. Your father was a Holocaust survivor. Your mother was a school teacher. What lessons did they kind of instill in you that you use in business today?
Well, my dad was when he came here, he's an engineer. So while I was a survivor, he wasn't in a camp. He just fought and killed a few people. So I didn't know that until I was 38, but. My dad, I think, just made me tough, and resilient and grit, because, my worst day was better than his best day during, he was only 9 when the war broke out and like 16 when it ended, and he became the head of the family and carried his mom, grandmom, his sister through, like, they live in the mountains of Czechoslovakia and came down and fought the Germans. So he's one tough cookie.
Yeah.
And he just passed away 3 years ago, but my mom's still alive. And my mom was creative. My mom was the painter. And because I had two brothers, I was the middle child, and I had to garden with her and learn the name of every plant. And so I wanted to be an artist, actually. And she told me I'd starve. And when my older brother's a doctor, so I had to be a lawyer. I applied to law school, and then I decided not to go. I said, I'm not going. She started to cry. And I said, don't worry, it'll work out. And it's worked out just fine.
So Barry, you went to Brown, and then take us to Barry when he was in his early 20s. You could have done anything. You could have gone to the business world. Tell me, kind of walk me through why you ended up going to business school and decided on Harvard Business School.
Yeah. Well, I was a liberal arts major at Brown, and I really thought I didn't know how to do anything. I never took a math course in college. That's when I chose Brown, because there was no core curriculum. You could do whatever you wanted. And so I took a job with a group, one of the investment banks, for the summer in equity research. And I kind of didn't like that, although I liked the markets. And I had taken a job out of Brown for somebody who doesn't know anything about anything, who becomes a consultant. So I got a job at Booz Allen, and I really didn't like that. Mm-hmm. So I went to be a trader, an arbitrage trader. And my father said to me, do you want to look at a screen the rest of your life? I'm like, oh, Dad, don't do that to me. So I decided I'd apply to business school and go learn business and finance and things I didn't learn in college. So it had a real purpose for me, but I was making good money as an arbitrage trader. So I only applied to two schools, Harvard and Stanford. I got waitlisted at Stanford. I got into Harvard, and I decided, I still wasn't sure I was going to go. And I got online to buy my first lottery ticket of my life. And I was standing in the long jackpot line, and I said, what would I do if I won? I said, I'd go to school. I go finish my education. So I went, and I was sure, with having never taken a math course and never finishing Algebra 2, I would be there for like 30 days and get thrown out. Mm-hmm. So turned out I found my space. I learned what I was good at, and being good at a lot of things and having common sense is a real skill.
We have a lot of young listeners. If there is
One lesson that you learned at HBS, what is that lesson?
Well, there are a couple, but the ones I talk about are the entrepreneurial finance professor. It's too early in the morning. I can't say that. Mm-hmm. And he said, find the freight trains in your life and get on them instead of in front of them.
That's and, smart.
And it was like, really like play the trends of your life as mm-hmm. a career. It just makes it easier. And hope is not a business strategy, which I tell a lot of people.
Cross off hope. That's basically my entire business strategy.
And mine.
So. Yeah. So did you get good at math? Did you get proficient at math? Because I'm someone who's bad at math.
You give me a calculator and I can do it.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah,
you know,
that's
like fair. I learned how to use that calculator pretty good. I'm fine with the basic math, you know, subtraction, addition. And in business, you really don't need much more than that. I'm not doing derivatives or, I remember when I interviewed for Booz Allen, they asked me what a logarithm was. And I said, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But actually that was the right answer. I think sometimes people pretend to know things that they don't know. And they wanted you to say, I don't know, but I'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, I tell my guys today, don't guess. Yeah. Like, no. And then tell me all the facts, not some of the facts. And then if you tell me that, and then tell me what your opinion is on those facts, then I know if you have good judgment. And if you have good judgment, you'll go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I think that was something he said to me in my first job out of business school. And I've really taken that to heart, because a lot of times you ignore the things that don't agree with your thesis or your ideas, and you may learn from those. And to me, the outliers are what you learn from. Like in baseball, why is one team doing so well and all the others are here? Don't ignore that team. Just study what they're doing really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And same thing in business. Why is one company traded a huge multiple and everyone else trades here? Or this business is broken. Maybe you'll learn from the outlier, not from the
So that's interesting to me, because you're obviously tremendously successful and you've been at the top of your profession. Is there a point where you start saying, well, I kind of do know it all a little bit?
So the biggest problem with success is losing your intellectual humility. It's exactly that, saying you figured it out, you know it all. And I'm friends with lots of billionaires, right? And I can,
not to brag.
Being one yourself.
Well, obviously they're friends with them.
Yeah, not to brag.
And it's interesting because the ones that go to work scared every day are the ones that are super successful. And the ones that run into the wall are the ones that say, I figured it out, I know it. Mm-hmm. And that's when you should get out of the game. Right. That's when, because you have to be all hands on deck to avert catastrophes in business. Right. And it might be, you know, we've made our share of mistakes over the years. And that's actually good, because I always said my first deal or the worst deal I ever did was the best deal I ever did. When I went to this company in Chicago, JMB, out of business school, we invested in a company in London, and we, you know, he was on the Forbes 400, my boss, and I was worth like $8,000, maybe negative $8,000. And he wanted to buy this company. I said, well, he's really rich and I'm just a pauper and 27 years old. And I thought I wasn't sure it was smart, but we did it and we lost all our money. And there was a second deal that before we lost all our money that I actually called him on and said, we can't do this. Mm. And he was on vacation and he was gonna lose a lot of money, and I stopped him from doing it. But that deal, we went bankrupt. And that deal went back. And I learned, like, you know, pay attention to details. They matter. Your opinion matters. And I stopped him from the second deal. He was going to do it. Because at the time, the wealthiest people in the world were the Canadian Reichman brothers. And they owned the property all over New York. And they built Canary Wharf in London. Everyone thought they're the smartest guys in the world. And they're spending. And, you know, so we followed them to London. My guy was like, you know, my friend Neil Bloom, who's a current, my mentor and friend at JMB, he thought the Reichmans were the cat's pajamas. And so we went over there and lost a lot of money. And for me, I got to learn that lesson with someone else's money.
Yeah.
Right.
So, but at what point, so I'll just say it, like, it does kind of sound like not lip service, but I always, when someone says my worst deal was my best deal, that couldn't have been that in the moment. Like, it must have taken a little time for you to be like, okay, that actually was my best deal. Cause in the moment it had to hurt.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So how long did it take to...
Well, I got fired.
Yeah,
well... I got fired. I actually got fired for that reason, but people thought it was for that.
Right.
I was 31, I guess, or 30, and I was a wunderkind there. I was like the number 10 partner, the youngest partner, I was really close to the founder. But the first big real estate crash took place with a collapse of the savings and loan industry. And they needed to get rid of expensive guys, not secretaries. Mm-hmm. So the guy who kind of was running the assets said, you know, take out the guys doing the deals. And I was the deal guy. So I kind of knew the handwriting on the was coming and the handwriting on the wall. So That was interesting, you know, going from watching Michael Jordan and Bears at every, in great box seats to being unemployed.
Right.
Perry, speaking of Michael Jordan, I mean, I've always told my friends, and when I go around talking to business schools, that Barry Sternlicht is the Michael Jordan, LeBron James, Tom Brady of real estate, of entrepreneurship. Kind of, I played for 23 years in the major leagues, and we only won one championship. And it wasn't because we weren't good. It's because it's really fucking hard to win and win big. And we did that in 09 here. But it's all about people in sports. It's the people that come in the clubhouse, and it's not just talent, but it's grit and it's discipline and all those things. You've always had a great team around you. Tell us kind of some of the things and attributes you look for in young entrepreneurs that you want as teammates.
Well, curiosity. And business is really important. I mean, you have to really be curious and like, because how did things affect? There are two types of people. I say there's box heads and spaghetti heads, and box heads. Yeah, I didn't think that was planned.
Yeah,
I got time up.
I'm very interested in this though.
Yeah.
Box heads and spaghetti heads.
Well, box heads think linearly. They're really good with numbers, but they can't think outside the box and they don't understand how things impact what they're looking at. Spaghetti heads think relationships, like, okay, this happens, then that happens, then that happens. I prefer the spaghetti heads, the people who can think bigger.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers are, a computer can do them, but mm-hmm. what do they mean? So curiosity, discipline, like they've done something in their career mm-hmm. that showed commitment.
Mm-hmm.
I like people who've had something tough that
right.
they've gotten through. So they show that they can bounce off the floor because everyone gets knocked down. Everyone. I mean, you had it with yourself, right?
Yeah.
You came back spectacularly. And that's a tribute to your character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and so character. I think also ethics are not even on the table. They have to be great. And today, I mean, I think you don't want somebody, you want somebody to speak their voice too. Like they, you know, it's okay to be shy, but I'm hiring people for their mind and their brains and their thoughts. And I don't want them to agree with me. Like mm-hmm. I want them to challenge my ideas and tell me like, what am I doing wrong? Like what am I missing? So one of the most important things I learned young, and I'll, to young guys are, sometimes you ask a question and you only ask questions from your own mind. The most important things are the things you don't know you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I call them the knuck-knucks, things you don't know you don't know. So in real estate, there was an example. My first deal when I came out of business school was to buy an apartment building in San Francisco. And I studied everything. I knew everything about everything. I talked to every tenant. I knew how long they were going to stay there, who their mothers were, how many blades of grass were outside. And I went to the investment committee meeting, and the head of the committee said to me, well, how far apart are the stripes in the parking lot? I'm like, excuse me? What are you talking about? He goes, well, you know, are they 12 feet or 13 feet? I said, I have no idea. And why could that possibly matter? He says, well, if we can make them smaller, we can fit more small cars in and we can charge $150 a month.
Mm.
And I'm like, oh, the things I don't know, I don't know. There was
a
deal here done in New York on Madison Avenue where we looked at the building and was bought by a Middle Eastern investor. And they added a floor to create additional space on the ground floor. So they now had two-story stores instead of one-story stores, effectively increasing the rentable space. And that was like really brilliant.
Yeah.
So I'm a student of things. I don't assume like people are always stupid. I think they might have a different angle.
Mm.
Right. And I think I try to understand why we lost when we do a deal and also what went wrong. Again, we manage $64 billion in capital today. So, I mean, we make our mistakes. You just want to be, as Alex knows, you do strike out a lot to hit your home runs.
Right,
you
know? Right. So you talked about bouncing back. Was that moment that you were fired at 31, was that your bounce back moment, or was there a different bounce back moment?
Well, if you go to entrepreneurship, that's when I decided I didn't want to do that again.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to work for myself. And my first child hadn't been born, and he was in the belly of my wife at the time. And I said, I'm not going to go through this experience again. I had an offer to go work at Goldman Sachs, and I didn't want to work in the city and collate papers and do all that stuff. So I went to this more entrepreneurial firm in Chicago. I'd never been in Chicago. And I decided I could do it on my own. You know, I'd give it a shot. I met a friend who said he'd back me. And I'm like, really? Because I was, by the way, I didn't do a lot of real estate for J&B. I did a lot of other things that they were doing. And he said, let's do real estate. So here's an example of not knowing anything, but being a hustler. I decided we were going to buy apartments because we didn't have any money for anything else. We only had $21 million, right? And you can't buy an office building. You maybe buy one. You're not going to buy a lot. This is 1991 or two. So we got to Denver, and I'm driving around with this guy who's going to teach me about apartments. And we're driving. I'm with a friend of mine who's going to be my partner. And the guy says, that building is, that's T111 siding. And I'm like, I didn't know what it was.
Right.
I'm like, is that good or bad?
Right.
So I waited, and then I asked, you know, and I think you have to ask. You can't be embarrassed. You have to ask. And,
is it good or bad?
What?
Is it good or bad?
It's bad.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
But I didn't know that.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I, you know, we backed away from the things everyone was doing, and we said, okay, what's the smart thing to do? Not what the institutions are doing, what all the money's doing. What's the smart thing to do? And in those days, instead of buying Denver where the institutions were, we bought Colorado Springs. Instead of buying Austin, and I'm sorry, instead of buying Dallas and Houston, we bought Austin and San Antonio.
Yeah.
And San Antonio was a fascinating market because the occupancies were higher, rents were higher, but the institutions didn't go there because it was Hispanic. But the Hispanics paid their rent, and they didn't, they always did.
Yeah.
Right.
They were very stable. They didn't move out. So we bought San Antonio. We made a lot of money. We tripled our money in 18 months.
So Barry, you go from being a 31-year-old, almost broke, jobless, as you're moving into this entrepreneur, you do not go to Goldman. You do have an HBS degree, and you're super smart, and you're hungry as hell. Tell us how you went from that to then running a public company and owning so many assets.
So, like I said, we bought about 8,000 apartments, three guys in a suitcase, in about a year and a half. And I sold them. We tripled our money. Mm. And investors tripled their money.
Sold to Zelle?
To Zelle, yeah.
Sam Zelle.
And that was my first millions of dollars. And, okay, it was, what was the next asset class to buy? Because apartments had run away from us on pricing. And we decided to start buying hotels. Because we looked at supply and demand, which is a basic concept in real estate. I don't think real estate's that complicated. It's supply and demand. And so we started buying hotels. I went to see Westinghouse Credit that was going out of business. And I said, do you have any apartments? They said, no. Do you have any land? No. Do you have any hotels? Yes. So it was Go Fish. So I was like, okay, go. And they had a guy who was selling a bunch of hotels. I convinced the guy that we'd have more fun doing the deal with us. He tied the deal up with a group in Boston. And he switched, and we bought this hotel portfolio. In that process, I met this company that was trading on the New York Stock Exchange that was going bankrupt. And I could see that they were gonna go bankrupt. So we found out who owned the debt of the company. And we started buying the debt. In the meantime, we were buying small hotels. I convinced them to, we went to them and said, we'll put cash, we'll put our hotels in and some paper we had on hotels. And we took control of this public company. It had a $7 million equity market cap and $200 million of debt. But we owned 3/4 of the debt. So we swapped the debt for stock. Mm-hmm. We did an IPO in 1995. That company was called Hotel Investors Trust. We called it Starwood Lodging Trust. And then we went off to the races. We started doing deals, hotel deals. I turned the Starwood Capital guys into the acquisition team for that public company. And we grew from 7 to about $5 billion in equity cap in 2.5 years. The stock was up 75% a year, every year, for 3 years. We were like a Snapchat. No, yeah. That's a bad example. Amazon.
Yes. Yes. Minus the robots.
And we grew and grew, and we, because we were growing earnings in the portfolio so fast, we had the highest multiple in real estate. So I bought Westin Hotels, and then I bought ITT Sheraton, and that was a $7 billion company buying a $14 billion deal.
Yeah.
And I was 37.
Wow. Okay.
And that's, so all of a sudden we had a $20 billion company.
Yeah. Dumb question. How'd you make the W Hotel cool?
Well,
it's cool.
So
like you go into it and you're like,
when
wow,
I was working
cool.
in Chicago, I'd come to New York and I'd stay in the Ian Schrager's hotels, you know, the Paramount, and I liked them. I thought they were cool, but I also thought there was a mistake, which was it wasn't business friendly. Like the TVs were too small and they were awkwardly placed in the room. So I decided I'd do a cool hotel, but not too cool. Cool, but you know, like I wanted the staff at W Magazine. Mm-hmm. I didn't want the total paparazzi because they're not loyal at all. I wanted the people who'd be loyal to us. So I didn't want to make it too chic. I wanted to make it reasonably chic.
Right.
And, you know, and have, anyway, so Condé Nast people stay with us, ad agencies, cool kids had some money also. So I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to build a branded boutique, and I started buying these independent hotels in Starwood Hotels, what became Starwood Hotels. And we bought the Doral's here in New York. We bought the Days Inn in Chicago. We bought the this hotel in Los Angeles. Now I forget its name. That became the W in LA on the West Side. So we bought all these independent hotels, and I took the flags down, redid them, and then launched them as W's.
What's the, you know, obviously most people think like a hotel is a hotel is a hotel, but when you stay at the W, you obviously, there's a little bit of extra special feel to it. What are the small details that you changed when you tried to make
it? I think it was interesting. I had an idea that design matters. You know, I'm one of two businessmen in the Interior Design Hall of Fame. So this is where my art background came
also
in.
Also, not to brag, that's just a statement of fact.
But that's my most important accomplishment ever.
Did you get a Hall of Fame jacket, like the NFL
Hall of Fame? I have a little plaque. Yeah. I could give you the plaque. It's not much. Yeah. But I actually got a kick out of that because I think we worked really well with. I used a lot of people that weren't in the hotel industry to do the hotels. I used set designers. I used some crazy people. And I launched a couple careers. Yabo Puschelberg, who's one of the biggest guys in the space today, they did their first hotel with us at W Times Square. And in the foreword of their book, they actually thanked me. And then I had a guy come up to me at our hotel, the Baccarat, here in New York, and say, "You changed my life." And I'm like, "Who are you?" He said, "You gave me my first hotel commission." So super fun. I'd rather talk about One Hotels, though, because it's
the new ones.
Yes. Yeah, they're kicking butt. So they're really exciting.
First, tell us about the Baccarat, and you sold that to a Chinese group.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that, and then why the One Hotel. I know it's doing wonderful. I stay there. For all our listeners, if you haven't stayed at the One Hotel, it is killer.
And it helps the environment.
And it helps the environment with a double bottom line. Tell us about your quick exit, and then tell us One Hotel.
The W grew to like 50 hotels, and then I decided I wanted to do it for myself. So I left Starwood Hotels. I went back to Starwood Capital Group. And I decided, what could I do in the hotel space that would make a difference? I had met Blake Makowski from Tom Shoes. Mm-hmm. And I kind of thought it would matter to do something important. My kids were into the environment. I was into the environment. And also Europe, one of the things I did with W was the U.S. industry, you don't remember, didn't pay attention. We were dumbing down the hotel experience. We took the bath mats out. We took the bathrobe out. We were going cheaper and cheaper and cheaper on the pillows. And the industry was just differentiating on price. I wanted to differentiate on design and let the price find its own level. Mm-hmm. And I knew that the original W's were just supposed to compete against Marriott, but they wound up being more upscale than that. One, I decided we'd go even higher. And it's the name I made up, but it's just like I made up W. It's one world. We're all responsible for each other. And what you do with your coal factories in China, you know, affects the weather in California.
Yeah.
So that's where the word one came from, and it's just a number. We're teaching people they can live well and live green, a green life. And it's been difficult, both from an operating standpoint. People ask for cans of soda, or they want bottled water, or they want their newspaper.
Straws.
We don't have plastic straws anymore.
Yep.
So my son's on a crusade with plastic straws. He's doing stuff with
the
UN.
That's the next big investment, is just be a plastic straw salesman. Because I feel like it's going to make a comeback. When they take it away, just sell it outside of every coffee
plastics
shop.
Plastics in general is extraordinary. I mean, what's happened, what the pollution is from that. But anyway, we have three operating ones, and we have about five under development that will finish, and then we have another 20. It's going to go faster than W Hotels.
They're fantastic.
They're in Paris. We have to do Paris, London. We're opening in Sanya, China, in Cabo, Los Angeles, Sunnyvale, Nashville, Melbourne, Australia. So there's a pile of ones coming.
How much capital have you invested into this so far, equity?
$400 or $500 million.
Chump change. Ashtray money.
Small investment.
Well, I mean, they're doing really well. I mean, it's interesting that, so that's another interesting thing today is that, and for your listeners, you can invent things today and get voice without a big company behind you. So that was the montage. Was a guy who actually left Sheraton Hotels, started by a guy named Alan Furstman. He did one hotel, and all of a sudden people in that market who need to know knew about that hotel. And so when I launched one, I was a little nervous. I have 12 guys in a briefcase behind me. I don't have 3,000 employees like Marriott does. And so we opened in Miami, which is the one Alex was referring to. And we are the highest performing hotel in the market. And we compete against the Ritz, the Lowe's, the everybody, you know.
What's your occupancy?
Everyone's there. 90%.
Wow. And what's the market for average?
84, 82.
Great hotel. You've been in there?
Yeah. I haven't been to the one in Miami, but I've seen the one in Brooklyn.
He lives near the one in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
The one in Brooklyn, which is getting higher rates than the hotels in Manhattan, is crushing it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think people, W wasn't for everyone. It was for a market. And one is for people who care about the environment. And people are moving out of the Plaza Hotel to come stay with us. Even our rooms in New York City are smaller. They just love the aesthetics and what we stand for. And we have farm-to-table restaurants. And we're very, like in Brooklyn, more than half the stuff was made locally.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's fun. It's fun. I don't need to do this for money. This one I'm doing for passion, for fun.
That's awesome.
And it's successful. You know, if you ask me, like, what I want to do, I want to do that.
Yeah. All right. So you have to run in a minute. I had a quick rapid fire, dumb questions from a dumb guy that I was hoping you could answer real quick. So why is there not menu guides in the TVs and hotels? Most hotels you go to, you can't scroll the menu. Can you answer that for me?
We have apps in the rooms that you can do that. We have like an iPad.
Okay, so you're fixing that. Good. Thank you. Why is the room never ready for the 3 p.m. check-in?
They're like, American Express gives everyone 4 o'clock checkouts.
Okay. My other question
we have a huge issue with that and we don't know how to fix it.
Yeah,
nobody knows how to fix it.
That's a big issue.
It's a disaster.
Okay. You need to create like a room, a chill room.
We are
that
doing
people
a chill
can
room.
Chill in.
We are doing a
like
chill room.
Couches, Xboxes.
Particularly difficult in resorts because everybody wants to stay that day and not pay for that night.
Yes, so, precisely.
Chill room.
Our wake up
calls.
Are you
taking notes? I hope everyone's taking notes.
Are wake up calls obsolete?
Yes.
No one uses them anymore, right?
Okay. Well, older people.
Is there like a person that they lost their job because of?
They lost their job a long time ago.
Yeah, okay, all right. My last question.
By the way, telephone revenue disappeared in a hotel, and the next thing to disappear is parking revenue.
Ooh.
Ubers.
Yeah.
And also movies, right?
Movies. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, if you order movies in a hotel room, does the front desk get to see what movie you ordered?
They do know.
Okay, that's also good to know. All right, last question. You once said.
You know what the average viewing time is of an adult movie?
Like, for me, this 90 is... seconds. But
yeah, I was going to say 3 minutes.
It was about 3 minutes.
Wow. Too many hotel rooms.
I just want to make the news.
All right, so last question for me. You once said that your goal was to just buy a house with a pool and a tennis court.
Wow, you've done your homework.
I've done my homework. How many pools and tennis courts could you buy right now?
Oh, boy.
Quite a few.
This is like how many ping pong balls can you fit in a 747 question?
Yeah,
he is managing $64 billion of assets.
A lot.
My last question is, one thing that a lot of our listeners do not know about Barry is that you're one of the biggest philanthropists in this town, and you know, not only a good friend of mine, but someone who I admire, who's a mentor, but not because of the $64 billion assets under management or because of all of that. It's really because the work you do with Robin Hood. We just had an incredible event this year. We raised over $50 or $60 million. You basically
headlined by Jennifer.
Begged me and pushed me and said, and you don't ask for favors, but it was so important for you to bring Jennifer to perform. She killed it. People were so happy. And the other part is you've given back to Harvard. You sit on the board of Estee Lauder. But just I want to end with your three kids because I know that's the most important assets in your life. One went to Dartmouth, one went to Stanford, one went to Brown. And then I want you to tell me what happened with Adrian this past weekend, which is pretty awesome. Why is education so important for them? And obviously you instilled that from your mother, but then tell me what Adrian did.
Yeah, so my kids, I think our job as parents is to give our kids the best education we can, and then they can make the choices of their own. And, you know, it's a journey for everyone. And everyone has ups and downs. I think those schools were good for they were good selections for those, for their personalities. If you've had children, you know they're all different. My daughter is a very good athlete, and she could have probably been an Olympic skier, but my ex didn't really want her to do that. So at the age of like 7 or 8, I made the mistake of letting her try out some ponies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she loved it. She loved the horses. She loved the whole scene. And I said to my ex-wife, I said, let her follow her passion, not knowing what her passion would cost. This is an expensive sport. But she went to Brown, and we had a deal with her that she could ride in this place called Wellington, which is where the professionals basically go in the winter. But she could ride like 4 or 5 of the 13 weekends of the festival, the riding festival. And she finished college. We wouldn't let her take her out or homeschool her. And then when she got out, she said, I want to do this for a couple of years. And I said, okay, let's go for it. And this past weekend, she won a gold medal for the United States.
That's amazing.
And finished in the World Equestrian Games, which is the off-season Olympics. The team, the U.S. team, qualified for the Olympics. She was the youngest rider on the team. And she finished 11th of 124 riders from all over the world, from, I think, 57 countries.
Okay, so let me bring some context to this, Danny.
This is one tough kid, because what people don't know, and NBC, which showed her live on Sunday, right before the golf, didn't know that she broke her hand 2.5 weeks
Ooh,
before.
Wow.
And I was like, she called me and she said, I broke my hand. I said, oh my God, I was like, you're kidding me. And I was afraid the U.S. team coach and the U.S. team doctor would pull her.
Mm-hmm.
She says, Dad, I'm riding. I'm like, I did the same break and it still hurts 6 months later.
Yeah.
And she took a week off and then she went back on the horse. She kind of, and she performed at the highest levels.
That's fantastic.
With a broken hand.
So
yeah.
Barry, who's done bigger deals than anybody on this planet when it comes to real estate and other ventures, who doesn't brag, was texting me and just, he was glowing.
Yeah.
It was like,
I was texting anyone I knew.
This is on the top of the list.
Way more excited than any deal he's ever done, which is awesome.
And I was way more nervous about anything I ever did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Watching her ride, but it was awesome. And you know, but it's interesting, grit, toughness, passion.
I love
success.
That.
Barry, thank you so much. Yeah. Our audience, listeners are going to love this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Last question. How much cash do you have on you? I asked. If you could give me some
cash. About $150.
All right. Well, maybe next time. Barry, thank you so
Thanks,
much.
Guys.
Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.